You could say, look, how should I design a job assistance program? It comes back down to something that's very familiar to most of us, that when you're trying to assist people, you do need to manage their expectations in some way. Thinking about those psychological dimensions of beliefs and expectations as much as trying to provide people skills.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Africa, we're often told, is the world's youngest continent, and right now, millions of those young Africans are looking for jobs. And what kind of interventions will help them in their search, and what gives them the best chance of long-run success? A multi-year experiment in Uganda, which is the second youngest country in the world's youngest continent, reaches some surprising conclusions. Anna Vitali and Imran Razul of University College London were two of the researchers, and they join me now. Anna, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. Hello.
And Imran, welcome back.
Hi, Tim. Pleasure to be here.
Now, Imran, start me off. How many people in Africa are unemployed now, and how bad is youth unemployment in particular?
Well, you're totally right to say that Africa is the world's youngest continent. So there are about 420 million young people in Africa today. Of those, 140 million are classified as being unemployed, and about another 130 million are underemployed or in working poverty. So overall, that means about two-thirds of young people in Africa today don't really have access to stable jobs. And so we observe those economies with large cohorts of individuals entering the labour market in search of productive work. That's true in just about most countries in sub-Saharan Africa, but especially in a very young country like Uganda, where the majority of the population is aged 25 and below.
You investigated in this research how to help young people find good jobs. And I suppose some people are thinking, why are they investigating this rather than finding out how to make more good jobs in the first place?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think a very tricky one to answer. And you're completely right that we can split the problem in two parts. On the one hand, we can think about how can we improve the quality of worker job matches. But on the other hand, we also need to create jobs in order for those matches to happen in the first place. And so I'm tempted to say that we tackled the first part because it was the easiest, but that's not actually true. So this paper is part of a larger study that actually looks at both workers and firms. And the objective of this study was, as you suggested, to understand, on the one hand, what is preventing youth from finding good, meaningful work, and on the other hand, what is preventing firms from creating jobs. For instance, if you think one of the constraints that might be limiting job creation on the firm side is that they find it difficult to recruit workers with the right skills, you might think that these constraints arises from both sides. On the one hand, you might have firms that are not able to screen workers. They can't really tell who is a good worker from who is a bad worker. But this constraint may also arise from workers not being able to target their search towards the firms that are good for them. So we believe that looking at the worker side and making sure that they know how to look for these jobs is as important as creating jobs.
So first of all, to find out how to get better jobs for job seekers, you need your job seekers. Where did you find them? What sort of job seekers were you looking for?
So this was a nationwide experiment, so not just taking place in Kampala, but throughout all areas of urban areas of Uganda, where we recruited people into our evaluation by offering them 6 months worth of vocational training at one of sort of the leading VTIs, vocational training institutes based around Uganda. The kind of training that we offered was in very important sectors for young people, welding, motor mechanics, construction, hairdressing, tailoring, and so on. And in particular, we had some eligibility criteria that really focused in on very disadvantaged young individuals, those who didn't really have many opportunities in the labor market before the evaluation. And if they were willing to potentially be offered this 6 months worth of training, then they could be eligible to join the experiment.
How would these people normally look for jobs? What have you decided that's wrong with the way in which they're looking for jobs?
So typically, these people rely on informal contacts to find a job. Think about asking a friend or a family member whether they know someone who has a vacancy. You know, the way in which people in high-income countries look for a job is by scrolling the internet, or maybe you guys were more familiar with ads in newspapers. in these countries, only less than 2% of workers actually find jobs through posted ads, most likely in newspaper. And the reason why firms and workers rely on these type of channels is because labor market entrants do not have the knowledge on how to search, and firms do not have the information on which workers are good, as I said earlier. And so the informal connections can help alleviate some of these constraints. However, the reason why this is suboptimal is that this process does not ensure that the best possible matches are formed between workers and firms. This means, for example, that the most productive workers may remain unemployed, or they might match with firms where they cannot express their full potential. So they're not good matches.
You emphasize, I noticed in the paper, that at the outset, these job seekers were over-optimistic about their chances of finding a job. I think this is pretty universal. I know I always have been. But why is this important for this research?
Job search is not that different from any other important forms of activity that we engage in. That how we do things often depends on what our underlying expectations or beliefs or even attitudes are towards that. And so in job search, that turns out to be hugely important. You could imagine that people could be over-optimistic and therefore think they're going to do very well, and that might drive them to be rationally exuberant, exert even more effort than they otherwise would have. Or you could imagine that in an economy like Uganda, where, you know, as we said at the outset, 2 out of 3 young people are unemployed, they may be overly pessimistic, and in that sense they might be discouraged and actually believe their chances are worse than is going to be the case. And if that's true, then they're going to undersearch and not have the possibility to engage in the types of interactions with firms that would happen if their beliefs were correct. So understanding whether people are over or under optimistic or pessimistic, is hugely important for understanding how people start to engage in search and the types of strategies they use in order to find jobs. And as we come to in the paper, those beliefs play a critical role in how people then respond to attempts to potentially help them with various interventions. And how they respond partly depends on whether they're over or under optimistic to begin with.
So you have your cohort of job seekers, and some of them are offered their training. What's this training like?
We offer our workers a training that lasts 6 months, and it's specific to a sector. So Imran mentioned the sector before. These are very hands-on, practical sectors. And so the training is also 70% practical, teaches workers exactly how to carry out some tasks. And only 30% of the course is actually dedicated to theory. So if you have to imagine this training, think about a tailor learning how to make a dress, or a plumber learning how to repair a sink, which seems quite important for the job. We actually do test whether workers have learned, able to perform these skills at the end of the training to validate that they were able to accumulate human capital. And we found that training does increase the skills that would allow them to find a job.
So does this make them even more optimistic?
Well, so let me go back to the underlying design of the experiment here. Remember, we said that we recruited them in based on the offer of job training. And so we didn't have enough funding to give them all this type of vocational training. So then we end up with essentially two groups, one treated group who received the vocational training that Anna's just been describing, and a set of unskilled workers. And that difference between that treatment and control group turns out to be hugely critical to then how their beliefs evolve later in the experiment. So for those who are assigned to vocational training, during that process, they become even more optimistic about their job prospects. They really sort of, at the point of graduating from the vocational training institutes, their beliefs are such that they think there's a 90% chance that they're going to be offered a job within the next month after having graduated. So they know that these skills are valuable. It's going to increase their likelihood to become employed or receive a job offer. But compared to the truth of what we actually observe happening to skilled workers, these beliefs of thinking that a job offer is going to come with a likelihood of 90% in the next month, it's just way off the truth. So they become even more optimistic, even more exuberant as a result of the training. That's in contrast to workers who weren't assigned the vocational training. They're just searching for jobs in the normal manner while the other group are getting trained. And we see them gradually becoming more and more realistic as they spend more time searching in the job market. And that's natural. These are young individuals. They don't have much experience when they first joined the experiment. And we just see that natural pace of learning take place over the first 5 or 6 months of the experiment. So what essentially happens is that we started with a group, all of whom are identical in terms of their belief, and you have this sharp bifurcation of beliefs between those who become even more exuberant because they've been given the training versus those who are gradually becoming more realistic in their expectations over time as they're just naturally searching in these job markets.
And there's a step two, isn't there? Because you also then offer some of this group assistance in getting a job. What sort of help are you offering?
That's right. We do offer workers job assistance. And the type of assistance we offer is very light touch. So all we do is we share the details of a few workers, either trained or untrained. And by trained, I mean the worker that underwent the 6 month vocational training, with firms that operate in the same sector in which they receive training. We provide very minimal and standard information. Think about the worker's sex, age, education, their work experience, and so on. And of course, we tell firms whether these workers receive training or not, without mentioning, though, that we were the ones sponsoring the training. And then we ask firms whether they would be interested in meeting any of the workers that are on the list that is presented to them. And if they say they are interested, we arrange the meeting between workers and firms. What is important here is that before even contacting the firms and finding out whether they are interested in meeting the worker, we need to pass through workers and ask them whether they would like to have their details shared with the firms. And so this might create expectations in what the workers might think is going on, in the sense that all eligible workers know that their information is passed on to firms and they might be expecting a callback from these firms. However, that's not what happens in reality, because only a few firms actually accept to meet the worker. And so the intervention basically turns into bad news for our job seeker. And you might think, we all receive rejection. That's not a big deal. That's not going to affect anything. But we all know that first rejections are the worst. And these are people who are entering the market and searching for jobs for the first time. And so although these rejections should not convey any deep information about the labor market prospects, workers do not really perceive it that way. And so they take these rejections much worse than they should.
I see. So, Imran, are we getting the opposite result from this, that they're getting discouraged rather than more optimistic?
Well, it depends which group we're talking about. So for the individuals who'd been through the vocational training, as I described earlier, they're getting more and more optimistic, more and more excited about being able to use these skills and go onto the job market. Then, as Anna said, we offer this very light touch job assistance, which is essentially just the chance for a firm in your sector in which you've been trained to call you back and say, look, we're interested in meeting you. Initially, we thought that was kind of a failure because so few firms call back. But the way that skilled workers respond to that is to become discouraged in many ways, that they very much internalize this bad news as really saying something about them. Whereas in fact, what we show is it's often driven by the fact the firm just doesn't happen to have a vacancy then. There are thousands of jobs out there. This is just one particular firm that said, look, we're not interested in you. But it comes at a time when these workers were really getting more and more excited about these new skills. This is kind of like a once in a lifetime chance for them to get these skills. They know they're valuable. And the first employer that they come into contact with says, actually, we're not interested in meeting with you. And so that causes their beliefs to move away and become more pessimistic relative to those vocational trainees that just went and searched for jobs themselves without us trying to offer them job assistance. But the process is quite different for workers who at the first stage were randomized out of the training and carried on searching as normal. Remember, I described they were becoming gradually more realistic over time. By the time we match them with particular firms and firms, you know, come back at the same rate and say, we're not interested in meeting with these workers, those workers, in a sense, kind of take it on the chin and say, well, I'm not so surprised by this. They don't take it so negatively. And in fact, we find that they respond in a slightly different way than the skilled workers in terms of perhaps for them really confirming, look, unless you actually do something and change the way you're searching yourself, you're not going to find employment. It's kind of like a confirmation for them. And so how the skilled and unskilled workers react to the job assistance is quite different and shapes the rest of the results in the paper.
Now, some people will be thinking, listening to this, but what really matters is who got a job. So who did get a job? What were the success rates for each of these groups?
So once again, it's important to disentangle what happened in the short run, immediately after we provided our interventions, and later on as workers search for jobs in the market. And what we see in the short run is that young people who went through the vocational training were more likely than untrained workers to be employed, and specifically be employed in one of the occupations in which we offer training, of course. Just to give you some number, we find that vocational trainees are 7 to 9 percentage points more likely to do any work. And this is a large effect if we think that at baseline, only 60% of workers were involved in any type of work. However, when it comes to the job assistance intervention, we do not really see any divergence in terms of labor market outcomes immediately after the interventions take place. What we see, though, is a divergence in the way in which they start searching for jobs. So among vocationally trained individuals, those who also receive job assistance on top of the training start to look less intensively. And this, remember, is consistent with them becoming discouraged from the bad news and revising their expectations about their prospects. And not only they start searching less, but they also search for a job in firms that are of lower quality. And this suggests that job assistance can discourage trainees when they receive the bad news, especially if they start from beliefs that are overly optimistic. On the other hand, workers that are only received job assistance but did not receive any type of training, remember, they just got a confirmation that their beliefs were right. However, we see that they start borrowing small amounts of money, and they do that with the purpose of starting their own businesses. Although, again, to reiterate, we do not see any immediate effect on labor market outcomes, we see that these changes in the way in which workers search for jobs are going to affect the labor market outcomes in the long run.
You really followed through on this, didn't you, Imran? Because you went back 5 years later to see what had happened. How were the outcomes different for the different groups after 5 years?
So I should say we've been tracking them for longer than 5 years, actually.
Crikey.
We've tracked them over the pandemic as well. So we'll have some, just to advertise some of our future work, we'll look at what happened to these workers pre and post pandemic. But the results in the paper really track them for 5-6 years after the interventions first took place. And again, just to emphasize, job search is a very dynamic process. So we think it's very important for this type of work to track workers over time and be key differences between what happens in the short term and what happens in the long term. As Anna was just describing, you know, we have changes in the short term of how they're finding searching for jobs. But you might say, look, in the long run, none of that matters. Once you get your first job, you will eventually find the job that you were going to find in any case. Who cares about how you're searching in the short run? We can clearly refute that sort of hypothesis in our data. We find that there are persistent effects on the types of work that these individuals are engaged in up to 5 years later. And that depends fundamentally on, one, whether they've been trained or not. But even more importantly, it depends on whether they were offered this job assistance or not. So when we look at vocational trainees who were additionally given the job assistance, which mostly represented bad news for them, we find that although they're doing much better than the control group, they're doing much worse than the vocational trainees that weren't given the job assistance. And that's driven by this slight discouragement early in their job search, which causes permanent reductions in their employment rates, in the types of jobs and firms that they're working at. In contrast, for the unskilled workers who reacted to the bad news of the job assistance by saying, look, I'm going to actually try to borrow some money, set up a small business. We find 5 years later, that's exactly what they're doing. They've set up in small scale self-employment. They follow through on what they said 5 years earlier. They're doing much better than the control group. So again, it really shows that in the long run, these small changes in trying to assist workers can really have big persistent effects on their lifetime outcomes.
Yes, I was surprised to read about how big these long-run effects were. Were you surprised, Anna, that the assistance had this kind of effect?
So for publication purposes, I should probably say things went exactly as we planned. but honestly, we would be pretty bad people if we knew that we would hurt these trainees and still followed through with the intervention. So no, these results were not at all what we were expecting. And what we found were the impacts on employment first. And for a good month, we could not really wrap our heads around what was going on, especially because we were also looking at search behavior in the long run. And so we couldn't really understand what was going on. However, when we started looking at dynamics, the various pieces of the puzzle came together. And here I must tell you an anecdote from the experience that I had with this project. I started working on this project about 7 years ago, and I was first, you know, the field manager. So I was working with interviewers and respondents. And I remember having calls with Imran and Imran completely refusing to cut down questions from the questioner and me getting mad at him because I was like, yeah, I mean, you want to keep all the information in there, but I'm the one who has to deal with the respondents and the interviewers. But retrospectively, I must admit that he was right because all this detailed information about the search behavior and the type of firms that they want to work in really allowed us to discover mechanisms that are not obvious and yet are very important in terms of their policy implications.
Well, Imran, having done all of that hard work and discovered these mechanisms, can we now conclude from that that some well-intentioned interventions, rather like yours, might possibly be doing more harm than good?
Yeah, so there's some subtle policy implications. All of the workers do better than the control group, so some interventions better than nothing. But I think there are some key lessons that we take away. One is that by trying to offer job assistance, there's two things the policymakers really need to think about, even if it's very, very light touch job assistance in the form that we offered. That one is that this may help lower skilled workers more than it helps high skilled workers. How workers responded to that kind of job assistance very much depends on the skills that they've got. And so workers who had been through the vocational training and were over-optimistic, in the end, that turned out not to be such a bad thing for them. It's good for sometimes for people to be exuberant and, you know, take those chances, take that leap of faith. We'd often think of the same in terms of innovation or some kinds of R&D activities. These young people are willing to take risks and it pays off for them. At the same time, targeting those interventions towards low-skilled individuals help them get up onto the job ladder and start in self-employment. You know, there are high returns to intervening in that way, as long as, one, it's targeted correctly. And secondly, you could say, look, how should I design a job assistance program? It comes back down to something that's very familiar to most of us, that when you're trying to assist people, you do need to manage their expectations in some way. So you need to make sure they know the way in which they're being assisted and what the implications are of both what we've been referring to as good and bad news, that in a sense, it's thinking about those psychological dimensions of beliefs and expectations as much as trying to provide people skills.
Finally, Anna, it's our tradition on Vox Dev Talks from time to time to make our guests policymaker for the day. First time off, you got promoted already. but this is a very serious matter, isn't it? Because this is the lives of hundreds of millions of people. And so if you were the policymaker for the day, what would you do based on this to help the lives of young people looking for jobs in Africa?
I already feel like a policymaker here. I'm very glad that I got this question. So this is a very hard question, of course. But to answer it, I actually want to refer to the findings that we have from a companion paper, just to summarize the findings from this overall experiment. And so in this companion paper, what we do is we compare the effects of vocational training and firm training. And what we see is that although both types of training have a large effect on employment and earnings, the effects of vocational trainings are almost twice as large those of firm training. And the reason why these effects are larger for vocational training is that workers who go through these type of trainings get their skills certified. And so they can go to potential employers, show them that they have these skills, they have these skills certified, and so they can find jobs. So from this paper, we take away that training is key in order for low-income countries to help this sea of workers transitioning into stable and skilled jobs rather than unskilled and informal work. However, it's important to keep in mind that for this program to have long-lasting effect, they should be paired with systems that allow job seekers to credibly certify the skills that they have acquired. From this specific paper on job assistance policies, the key takeaway is that when we have policies that might intentionally or unintentionally provide workers with information on their labor market's prospects, and especially if these workers have limited experience in the labor market, we should carefully design and carefully target who are the recipients of the intervention. And this is because having limited experience in the labor markets, these workers might overreact to the news that is provided to them, and this might backfire in the long run. So this gets us back to the original question. We now have a better idea of how we can fill the existing job slots, but how do we create more jobs in the first place? Well, I hope you invite me again when we release new work on this second question, and I will tell you more about that.
Well, I don't make the rules, Anna, but I will if I possibly can. Thank you very much. This is really high stakes stuff. So thank you very much. Well, first of all, for putting such a lot of effort into doing this research. It's a big project. And thanks for talking about it today. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
And Imran, thank you as well.
Thanks, Tim.
The paper's called The Search for Good Jobs, Evidence from a 6-Year Field Experiment in Uganda. And the authors, a lot of authors, Oriana Bandiera, Vittorio Bassi, Robin Burgess, Imran Razul, Munshi Suleiman, and Anna Vitali. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. Well, and then you can hear quite a lot more from some of those authors I've just listed. For example, recently we've been talking to Munshi about using role models in Somalia's schools. That was a great one and quite controversial, it turns out, from the response that I got when I posted it on Instagram. Robin on whether electricity is a right. Oriana was talking to me recently about how social structures affect the success of development policies. And of course, we talked to Imran before on prenatal interventions in Nigeria. All great podcasts. You can read about the episodes and listen to clips by following Vox Talks Economics on Instagram. Really recommend that. And of course, our past episodes with articles about the research are at voxdev.org.